So welcome back, folk. Tonight we're going to begin a new seminar series, and we're going to be looking at the myths and parables, the stories from this particular sutra in the Buddhist tradition. It's a very renowned, revered sutra called the White Lotus Sutra, the Sudama Pundarika Sutra, which is sometimes translated as the Sutra of the Lotus of the Wonderful Law, or sometimes as the White Lotus Sutra. Pundarika is a lotus, but it's also a white lotus. And yes, some schools of Buddhism revere this sutra very, very highly. It's said to be the, you know, the pinnacle of the Buddha's teaching. But of course, it wasn't. It's a sutra that was, historically, it's not been the Buddha that taught it. It wasn't the historical Buddha who taught this sutra. It comes after the Parinirvana of the Buddha, probably a few hundred years, maybe 500-600 years after the Parinirvana of the Buddha. So it's a later sutra. But those later sutras, the Mahayana sutras, as they're called, they didn't have a sense of history to them. They were written, composed, told, recited, as if they were the word of the Buddha, as if the Buddha was teaching them. But the Buddha in the White Lotus Sutra isn't just the historical Buddha. He's an archetypal Buddha who is capable of working wonders, and he's got magical powers. He's all-knowing. He's eternally youthful. He lives forever. He's preaching this sutra not just to human beings, but to the whole panoply of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and non-human beings, and it's a cosmic drama that is unfolding. In fact, it's said that he's giving this discourse that is the White Lotus Sutra on a pinnacle called Vulture's Peak. Vulture's Peak is a historical geographical site. You can go to Vulture's Peak. It's in Bihar. It's a rocky, huge, huge rocky crag that rises up on a flat plain, Gridhrakuta, and it's said that the Buddha taught the White Lotus Sutra at the very top of this enormous crag. I've been at the top of this peak, Vulture's Peak, and it's just fantastic. You can see for miles. It's not that it's enormously high, it's not like a mountain, but you can see for miles, partly because the landscape around it is completely flat, and it's very dramatic the way it just comes out of this flat landscape. And in Indian mythology, in Buddhist mythology, Vulture's Peak represented the peak of samsara. It was the highest point in the world. I mean, it's not, obviously, but it was mythologically, it was the very pinnacle of mundane existence, as if everything above Vulture's Peak is the transcendent realm. And of course, that means that the Buddha is giving this discourse just where samsara meets nirvana. It's this boundary between the mundane and the transcendental. And this discourse is coming out of that realm. These Mahayana sutras are like, they're a bit like modern day science fiction in a certain sense. They don't belong to normal time and space. They don't belong in this world of gravity and natural kind of laws of physics. They defy all sorts of things. So, for example, the sutra begins with the Buddha sitting on Vulture's Peak in meditation, surrounded by innumerable beings, followers, disciples, arahants, bodhisattvas, non-human beings. They're all arrayed around him. And suddenly, from the Buddha's forehead, between his eyebrows, comes a beam of white light. And this white light, like a laser beam, illuminates the entire cosmos. And as all the disciples and the bodhisattvas, as they as they look up, suddenly they can see an infinite number of world systems, as they're called, other universes, other solar systems, other galaxies. They can see them all lit up. And in each one of these different universes, there's a Buddha teaching, just as he's teaching on Vulture's Peak. There's a Buddha expounding the Dharma to other countless beings. So it's this vast kind of cosmic vision which does mean something. It does mean something. It's trying to say something about the nature of the Dharma. It's trying to say something about the universal nature of the Dharma, about the fact that it's not just a historical Buddha teaching 2,500 years ago in a particular historical land and time and place to some, you know, few hundred people. It's saying that the Dharma is a cosmic truth, a universal truth that has no boundaries to time and space. It's saying other things besides. Bante, I'm going to be drawing, by the way, on Bante's commentary on the sutra, or on aspects of the sutra. The sutra itself you can find in a book like this. I mean, this is the version I've got. So, I mean, actually, this is more than the White Lotus Sutra. It's got two other sutras in as well. But that's the sort of length of it. That's the length of it. Bante, in this commentary... This commentary is a series of lectures that he gave. In this commentary, he particularly focuses on some parables, stories that are contained in the White Lotus Sutra. But anyway, the Buddha... So get back to the sutra. This beam of light comes out, and this wondrous spectacle is seen by everybody, somehow. And Maitreya, who's the... Well, Maitreya is sometimes seen... Well, he's the future Buddha. He's the Buddha to be. So Maitreya is in the assembly, and he says, "What's going on? What's going on? What's happening?" And he asks, well, Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, the archetypal bodhisattva of perfect wisdom, I think he's sitting next to Maitreya, so Maitreya turns to Manjushri and says, "What's going on? What's happening? Why is the Buddha emitting this beam of light that lights up all countless universes? And what's the significance of this?" And Manjushri knows. Manjushri says, "I think the Buddha is about to teach the White Lotus Sutra." So already that's a bit weird, isn't it? Because that is in the sutra. So we're in this White Lotus Sutra, and it's very postmodern. It's very knowing, because the sutra refers to itself as, you know, the Buddha is about to teach the White Lotus Sutra. Incredible, in a way, that this is the product of the Indian mind from thousands of years ago, that very kind of mind-bending stuff happening even before any kind of word is spoken by the Buddha. And the Buddha speaks. The Buddha does speak. He says yes. He opens his eyes. He speaks. And, well, he talks about the nature of enlightenment. He talks about how enlightenment is much, much, much more than any of those gathered around him realize. He says that enlightenment is not just about the eradication of negative mental states like greed and hatred. Although that's necessary, that's just the start. The enlightenment is about developing the positive qualities of wisdom and compassion for the benefit, for the sake of all sentient beings. It's about becoming, well, a Buddha, a perfectly enlightened one. So what he's doing is he's taking a lesser vision of enlightenment and saying that's not enough. He's saying, no, it's about, it's not a personal affair. You or me becoming enlightened, that's not what it's about. It's about becoming enlightened so that we can help or save or for the sake of all beings throughout the whole universe. You know, it's this cosmic grand kind of vision. The Buddha's saying that so far I've only taught you the beginnings of this. There's much more to say. There's much more to learn. I'm not going to go into all the sort of technical backgrounds of this, but one thing I will say is that the sutra is very obviously a critique of a view of enlightenment that had probably taken root by the time the sutra was composed. A rather narrow view, a personal view, that enlightenment could be achieved just for my sake by getting rid of, egotism, greed and hatred and all the roots of egotism. That's all that I had to do, as it were. Hard enough, but that's quite a narrow vision from the perspective of Mahayana Buddhism. And this sutra is saying it's far too narrow. What about the compassionate aspect? What about the suffering of all sentient beings? If you just want to get enlightened to save yourself, you haven't really achieved enlightenment. That enlightenment can't be a private, personal salvation. That's what the sutra is getting at. It's a critique if you want to see it from a historical point of view, it's a critique of earlier forms of Buddhism, or at least their degeneration. Yeah. But in a more mythic context, the Buddha is, on Vulture's Peak, saying that there's much more that he hasn't revealed. And what happens, interestingly, is that some of the disciples, some of them, are disgusted, shocked, and angered by the Buddha saying that there's more to enlightenment than they have already realized. So these are people who think of themselves as enlightened. They don't want to hear the fact that there's more. Yeah. So it's said that 5,000 of them walk out. They walk down, I guess. they just leave. They leave the assembly in disgust. Thus, to my eyes, showing that they're not as spiritually developed as they... You wouldn't walk out on the Buddha, would you? Not when he's emitted this beam of white light and lit up the cosmoses. And then you think, oh no, there's nothing more to learn. I'll just go down and, go have lunch or something. But that's what they do. And of course, this is indicating something, a danger in the spiritual life that is particularly there if you've been practicing for some time, but maybe it's there from the beginning. It's this attitude that we know it all already, and we're not open to hearing any more. Yeah, really, really insidious attitude that actually stops all further growth and development. And it was obviously there 2,500 years ago in the Buddha's time, and well, it's definitely there in our culture, in our time. I've had people walk out on me, not 5,000, but then I've never taught 5,000 people, so one day. You can see it in our culture. But anyway, I'll move on. So Shariputra, one of the Buddha's disciples, one of his main leading chief disciples, is really perplexed. He's really perplexed by what's been happening. First of all, of course, there's this vision. Then there's Manjushri's statement that the Buddha is about to give a profound teaching called the White Lotus Sutra. Then the Buddha says that nobody has really understood what enlightenment is. It's far, far bigger. Then these people have walked out. So there's a whole drama unfolding already. Shariputra then says, please, could you explain what you're talking about? What is going on? Could you explain it in another way to the Buddha? I mean, he says it more respectfully than that. And it's then that the Buddha gives his first, well, the White Lotus Sutra, gives the first parable. It's a parable spoken by the Buddha, sort of as an explanation of what he meant. And in this sutra, there are lots of parables. They're stories. Actually, the White Lotus Sutra has very little conceptual teaching to it. Buddhism does use the language of concepts, of, well, for want of a better word, philosophy, of ideas, of views, and it can use that language in a very, very sophisticated way. But it also uses the language of imagination, of poetry, of myth, of story. And I think we need both. Well, it's not that I think we need both. Bhante says we need both. We do need both. One or the other isn't enough. We need to address the whole of our psyche. And aspects of our being don't respond just to ideas. Parts of us are moved by stories, by images. And this sutra teaches the Dharma through stories. So over this series, we're going to be exploring some of those stories. And hopefully we'll sort of explore the meaning behind some of those stories. They seem very relevant, as relevant as ever to us today, if you unpack them. And yes, we'll be using as our guide Bhante's commentary on those stories, which is available in the bookshop. This commentary is called The Drama of Cosmic Enlightenment. The Drama of Cosmic Enlightenment. So the first story, you ready for a story? It begins with an elder, a wealthy man, who owns a large house. It's like a mansion house, a very, very large house. The only thing is that it's not in a great state of repair. It's tumbling down, it's decaying, it's rotting, it's in a real state of disrepair. Yeah, so it's a sort of ruined mansion. And the man, who's sort of not named, has many children. The wives or mothers of the children aren't mentioned, but it's said that he has as many as up to 30 children. They're all in the house. They're all in the house. And they're all playing in the house. They're running around, playing games, screaming and shouting and running and chasing each other and playing games, enjoying themselves, sort of oblivious of the sort of fact that there are dangerous, unsafe areas in the house, you know, bits of floor missing maybe, and, you know, unstable roofs and glass that's broken. But anyway, they're playing in this house. There are also said to be ghosts in the house. The house is said to be haunted with ghosts, which is interesting. Anyway, they're all playing in this house. The man, their father, is outside at the time when a fire begins in the house. So, because of the rotting, decaying nature of the house, perhaps, this fire soon spreads and becomes a conflagration. Which is seen by the man. He suddenly sees it from wherever he is and runs towards the house to save his children. And he's about to sort of go in and try and bring them out. But he realizes that he's never going to be able to save each one. You know, he's got 30 kids in this huge house. He's not going to be able to do it on his own. And he calls to them. He calls to them saying, "Fire, the house is burning, get out." But the kids, the children, are oblivious to the fire. For whatever reason, they do not realize that the house is burning and that they are in danger. So they know their dad's sort of saying something outside, but frankly they're too busy playing their games to be interrupted or have them spoilt by their dad shouting something. So they carry on playing as normal. So the man is now in desperate panic. You can imagine the sort of quandary he's in. Should he rush in? Should he save who he can? The kids won't listen. He's screaming at them. He's screaming fire. The house is burning more and more vigorously. What's he to do? And, well, according to the parable, what he does is he entices the children out by shouting at them that he's brought them loads of toys, loads of new toys, toys for each child. And this being ancient India, it's not iPads and the like. It's carts, deer-drawn carts, goat-drawn carts, and bullock carts. And of course, the kids love a cart. And he says, "Look, I've got all these carts. Come and see the carts. Come and play with the carts." And so he shouts this, and it works. The kids are suddenly entranced by the notion of new playthings, deer carts, goat carts, and bullock carts, and they come tumbling out of the house, pushing each other actually out of the way. They're sort of quite rough with each other. They come tumbling out of the house. Each of them manages to make it out of the house, still quite oblivious to the danger that they were in. And of course they want their carts. And the man, because he's wealthy, can afford carts, it's said. And he does give them carts, even though that was just a ploy at getting them out. He does give them carts, and he gives them a bullock cart each, with decorated with banners and bells and the like. And bullock carts were the real deal. I mean, that's what you would want. You wouldn't want a deer-drawn cart or a goat-drawn cart. You'd want a bullock cart, obviously. And each of them is delighted that they've got a bullock cart. And that's it. So that's the story. Each of them is it all ends very happily. So, yeah, it's a very simple kind of parable, isn't it? It's a very, very simple parable. And it's trying to point to something that's relevant for us. So let's try and just unfold the story a little bit. So who do you think symbolically the man represents? The elder, the man with all the kids, in this story, from a Buddhist perspective, who is he? He's the Buddha. That's right, that's right. He's the Buddha. Not the Buddha as, although he's the father of these children, he's not the Buddha as in a creator god, not as in our Father who art in heaven. He's in a way, he's their guide, he's their teacher, he's their elder. But of course, Buddhism doesn't believe in a creator as a being, as it were. But yes, he's the father. He's the Buddha. So what about the children? Who are the children?
Us.
Us. Yes, us. That's right. We who are playing our games, oblivious of the danger that we're in, but who are hungry for toys, for bullock carts particularly. Yes, we're the children. By us, what's meant is all unenlightened beings. So you've got the enlightened perspective from outside the house, and then you've got unenlightened beings, us, in the house. And what about the house itself? What's the house? The burning house. Yeah, it's the world. It's the world, it's samsara. It's all conditioned existence. It's all conditioned existence. So it's this realm that all unenlightened beings inhabit. And it's on fire. It's on fire. There's a sutta from early Buddhism, a sutta that is in the Pali Canon, which is, you know, the texts, the teachings that are closest to the historical Buddha. One is called the Fire Sermon. Have you heard of the Fire Sermon? Eliot refers to it in, well, it's a section of the Wasteland. And in the Fire Sermon, the Buddha says, all is burning. Everything is burning. It's burning with the fires of greed, with the fires of hatred, with the fires of delusion. Everything is burning. So samsara is burning with those fires of greed, of hatred and delusion. And all unenlightened beings, all of us, are in this burning realm, in this burning realm. But we don't recognize that it's burning. This is, I think, one of the most poignant things about this parable, is that the kids carry on playing. They carry on playing their games. and we too carry on playing our games. Bandy talks about us playing our psychological games, our, well, the game of life. We carry on playing, sort of oblivious to the danger that we're in. I mean, I think we carry on playing in the most shocking way. I mean, I can turn on my laptop, read about some atrocity happening, I don't know, in the Middle East, it seems, at the moment, or maybe it's somewhere else on the other side of the world. Read about the horrors that people are experiencing, and then think, oh yes, I'll have my breakfast, and make some porridge and tea, and then get on with my day. And it's slightly shocking, isn't it, that I can sort of be aware of the horrors in the world and actually also be completely oblivious to them, almost at the same time. And we do that, don't we? I mean, I'm not sure that what else I could do. But certainly there is a certain shutting down that can't be right, a closing down of awareness that can't be right. I mean, what does the burning house conjure for you, this image of the burning world?
Time ticking?
Yeah, time. Can you say more about time? Because it's true.
Possibly the idea that we are unaware of how short,
yes,
life
will be. Yeah, that's right. How short life can be, and how precarious our existence, our human existence is. It's a very, very slender thread, isn't it, between life and death at times. You know, if I think about death and I try and reflect on death, somewhere in my mind, it's still far away. And of course, it could be, but I really don't know. Yesterday I was listening to some talks. We had an order day, and there were some talks on the subject of old age and sickness and death, the first three sights that the Buddha saw. And one person was talking, and she was talking about how her first thought every morning is, oh, I've made it through the night, I've got another day, I've made it through, you know, the last night. And then she said, it never seems to occur to me that I could die in the day. I may not have another day. I could die any moment. So even her, who reflects on death every day, there's a sort of turning away from this fact that it could happen any moment. Any moment. None of us knows how long life is. None of us actually knows whether we'll make it home tonight. We all assume we will, and hopefully we will, but we really don't know. That's how uncertain it is. That's how uncertain it is. But also, whenever it happens, well, the one certainty is that it is going to happen, and that I suspect that from the perspective of death, however long we've lived, life will seem short. It will feel as if, oh, it's over, in a flash. And I guess from that perspective, well, I hope that we can all sort of, when it comes to that point, and if we're conscious, that we can feel satisfied with how we've lived. But I think unless we've really reflected on life, if we've just spent our life chasing after foolish things, then we won't feel satisfied. We won't feel satisfied. So yes, this burning house, I think, conjures up, as you say, this sense that life is short, that time is passing, that the only certainty is that it will end, and we don't know when. Yeah. Yeah. Anything else conjured up by this image?
Thinking of a different image of a mouse and a mouse trap with a bit of cheese.
Ah, yeah.
You sort of go for the quick fix and the tasty little thing, but you don't kind of see this sort of broader danger that's overhanging it.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah. Just a little bit of pleasure and we can forget everything. A little bit of enticement and we can forget the danger that we're in. Yeah.
Ignorance?
Say that again?
Ignorance.
Ignorance, yeah, say more. Yeah, that's right. So in a way, that is the state of the children. It's ignorance, and it's the state of all unenlightened beings. From the Buddha's perspective, we really are like children, running around, playing, without any real sense of what's really happening. And that is, in a way, spiritual ignorance. That's no matter how clever we think we are, no matter how... many facts we have accumulated and how, cleverly we can speak about all sorts of subjects. From a spiritual perspective, from a dharmic perspective, we're kids, ignorant children, spiritually ignorant, unless we've woken up to the preciousness of life and the danger of this existence, and unless we're trying to wake up to... well, the Buddha's teaching. Yeah. So the fires of ignorance, yeah.
I think it's interesting that it's fire.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what it means, but the fact that it's fire and heat rather than crumbling down or being drowned in water or being blown away by winds. So something in the image of fire.
Yeah. There is something, I think, very vivid about fire. You can almost hear it, can't you? And well, I can if I picture it in my mind, these sort of crackling flames. The awfulness of burning, somehow, as well. And the fact that it can be happening and you not know it or something, in the next room. The sort of quickness of fire. And it's active. Somehow fire feels alive, doesn't it? As if it's got an energy, a will of its own. It's not just a passive danger.
But it can be transformative as well.
Fire can be, that's right. Fire in Buddhism isn't always a negative symbol at all. Actually, fire can transform and transmute something into something much more pure and refined and positive. So yes, often it's used as a very positive symbol of burning away of egotism, of all our self-centeredness, of all our ignorance. The flames of shunyata are a very, very positive image. Yeah. I was just thinking though well, fire reminds me of the environmental crisis that we're all in, actually, of global warming. We're in it. And it might be that we're doing everything that we can in our own sort of little sphere of influence. But personally, even though I, in our community, we do recycling. We're vegetarian. That's a big step from an environmental perspective. Just the fact that there's nine of us sharing one washing machine and cooker and all the rest of it is a step. But personally, I still have not woken up to the threat, the real threat of the danger that we're in. Somewhere along the line, I I've sort of turned my back on it. It's not that I feel I can do very much more, although probably I could, but it's more that I don't. There's a certain ignorance to it. And collectively, as a culture, and this goes for probably most cultures and countries, we've got this collective blindness, even though we're being told pretty much every day that we're in terrible danger as a species, and we're in danger of destroying other species as well. And collectively we've been told that. It's almost too much to take in, isn't it? It's almost too much to... And you think, oh well, oh dear, I'll get on with my life. I'll go shopping or whatever. Wanted to read you something, just a few sentences from... In this book, which has recently come out, which I really recommend, The Buddha on Wall Street by Vardika, who's an order member in Sri Ratna. It's a book about Buddhist... a Buddhist response to capitalism. And he quotes from a commentator, an academic called Tim Jackson, who is, he says, professor of sustainable development at Surrey University and author of a book called Prosperity Without Growth. And he's talking about this mania for economic growth that, you know, that we're all led to believe is the only answer, you know, that every year we have to be getting richer. And he says it's a story about us, people, being persuaded to spend money we don't have on things we don't need, to create impressions that don't last on people that we don't care about. That's brilliant, isn't it? It's a story about us, people, being persuaded to spend money we don't have on things we don't need, to create impressions that don't last on people that we don't care about. And that is a collective delusion while the world is on fire. And we're just playing some silly game called shopping, and we're all at it. So that's another image for me, another connotation of this image of the burning house for me. Yeah.
I wonder if there's something in the fact that it's a big mansion that's on fire as well. So it's not a haystack or a forest fire, but it's, he's a rich man.
Right, right, yeah, yeah. So his wealth doesn't save him. Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, and it was tumbling down. Samsara may look pretty and shiny, but it's actually, we're living in a world of decay all the time. Again, this is pointing to ignorance. And yes, all the wealth in the world can't stem the tide of impermanence, sickness, old age. The body is like this burning house, in a way. It's rotting. Well, at least after a certain age it is. Maybe I should speak for myself. But it's the human condition. It's the human predicament. And no amount of money or luxury is going to save that. So yes, I think that's... What about the ghosts in the house? Any thoughts on the ghosts? What do they represent?
Does it say much about what the ghosts are getting up to?
I don't know if it does. I mean, Bhante doesn't talk about what they're getting up to, but he does mention them. This, the fact that this house is haunted.
Ghosts tend to be quite unsatisfied, don't they?
The hungry ghosts, yeah.
Yeah, they tend to kind of inhabit the area where they've been unsatisfied to try and find some sort of, I don't know, just find some sort of resolution or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like they're hanging around because they haven't been fulfilled. I mean, another way of thinking about it, this is, I think what Banti says. It's like we're haunted by the past, aren't we? We're haunted by stories of the past. We're haunted by our own stories of who we are. We're shaped by that. I don't know if you've ever told your life story. If you've told your life story, it's sometimes, well, it's a practice that we do in the Sangha where, you know, you have an hour, maybe 2 hours, maybe more, to just tell your life. And it's I'd really, really recommend doing it. it's sometimes revealing, when I've told my life story, what comes out. Because it is a story. I can't in 2 hours tell you, well, I can never pin down every incident. So I have to select particular episodes and incidents and points in my life and then string them together in some sort of coherent narrative. And I weave a story when I tell the story of my life. And I reach certain sort of conclusions. Oh yes, you know, I'm like this because this happened. But then if you do this practice again, I mean, I've told my life story several times over a number of years, the story changes. Not consciously, not because I think, oh, I've lived a different life, but because what you focus on depends on how you are now. And the story changes. The past isn't this immutable, fixed entity, at least not in the sense of the past as it exists in our mind. We have a story, we have stories that we tell ourselves that justify our present life. I'm like this because of this, etc., etc. So maybe the ghosts are something of that. Any other ideas about the ghosts? I'm trying to find what Banti has to say exactly. Yeah, there's. Yeah, that's unnoticed. I think that's quite interesting. I think we very easily, I think, in our culture, assume that if we can't see something or hear it or touch it with our, you know, with our five senses, then it doesn't exist. That this experience, this reality that it presents itself to the five senses, is all there is, and from a Buddhist worldview, that's not the only thing. That's not the only reality that there is. There are all sorts of other levels of reality, all sorts of other beings, non-material beings, that inhabit the universe that we ordinarily are not always aware of. And our sort of scientism, our belief that, you know, everything that you can see and touch and point to is all there is a sort of, well, it is a belief. It's a belief rather than, a proof. And that scientism is very narrow. It's a very narrow belief. It really limits our worldview. As well as being impoverishing, I think it really diminishes what our view of life is. This drama of cosmic enlightenment takes place over eons and over the whole cosmos. But what happens is if we have this narrow view, I don't know, our life, no matter how long it is, it's never going to be much longer than 100 years, is it? And if that's it, if that's all there is, that we exist for this sort of blink of an eye and then we're snuffed out, and this material world is all there is, then enlightenment, at least in the traditional context, and to me, doesn't make sense. You might as well play your games in the burning house as best you can, enjoy yourself while it lasts, make the best of it, if that's all there is. Of course, Buddhism says it's not all there is, that we're, this burning house isn't just for this lifetime. Buddhism sees all unenlightened beings as trapped on this wheel of life that is this relentless cycle of birth and death and rebirth and re-death. This cycle that is without beginning and potentially without end. Each life we're trying to become happy, fulfilled, and each life ending in not being completely fulfilled and in suffering and sickness and death of some sort, and then a rebirth where we go round the same wheel again. From a Indian, traditional Indian perspective, this is a horrible vision. It's not like, oh goody, I can come back and have another pot shot at it. It's this horrible vision of relentless striving and fruitless suffering. And nirvana, enlightenment, is said to be, well, a complete escape from birth and death into complete freedom and peace, however that is conceived. So do you see that our narrow vision, our sort of scientific materialist vision, is very, very impoverished compared to this vast cycle? And then what about the toys, the bullock carts, the other carts? What do they represent?
I was thinking of the ghosts as as really of the beings that are participating almost in this samsara. And the children playing with the carts, what it reminded me a bit of, is it reminded me maybe as a practitioner, how you kind of, I feel like often I'm tricking myself into practicing.
So ah, yes.
That I find beautiful in my practice, or kind of reward ways to make it enjoyable, make it beautiful. Whereas I think, kind of saying that just saying fire isn't enough, and that there's got to be other ways to look, to bring you in somehow.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a really important point. Bhante makes this very similar point, that just saying fire isn't enough to bring the children out. I mean, they don't listen to the fact that the house is burning down. They need some sort of positive enticement, some sort of positive, pleasurable, beautiful enticement that motivates them to come out. Danger and suffering aren't always enough to motivate us to leave the burning house. The elder, the father, the Buddha, recognizes this. It's a sort of psychological truth that yes, they need some sort of positive enticement. And so he, in a way, he tricks them out of the house. He tricks them out of the house by promising them something that he knows that they'd want. And I think in our own practice, as you say, we have to sometimes sort of do that.